This week, we interview Ben Williams, the legendary proprietor of the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. We talk about his curious path that led him to Freemasonry, Masonry's duty to the world.
Are there other things we can do to exemplify a philosophical shift in consciousness that may usher in a more sustainable and equitable future? Right? If everybody consumed at our level, four Earths would be required to sustain the global economy.
Occult traditions.
So the lodge, when it functions properly, exemplifies a type of virtue that I believe affects the entire community surrounding it.
And even Skinwalker Ranch. Get ready for 60 Minutes with the Curious Ben Williams. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
All right, everybody, welcome back. This is episode number 447. Not a whole lot going on in the news. As you know, we are not putting out any advertisements for any ways to promote this show during the pandemic times. So just want to give a quick shout out to all of our producers, fellows, and contributors, those who support this show via PayPal, via Patreon. Thank you guys so much for signing up and for making the show happen and keeping all the episodes available all the time. I want to say also thank you so much to everybody out there who listened with an open mind, open heart to our last episode, number 446, America 57, The Interview. We had a lot of great support with that one, and I just want to say thanks very much for, again, open mind, open hearts. This week, as you heard in the opener, we got a great interview with Brother Ben Williams of the Rocky Mountain Mason, Mason of the Year 2015. So without any further ado, let's get into this rad interview. All right, everybody, we are back this week. I've got a quite esteemed brother with us. This is Brother Ben Williams of the Rocky Mountain Mason Magazine, Laughing Lion publisher, and a whole lot more. He's a podcaster now. Brother Ben, thanks for coming on the program.
Brother Audrey, thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, you know, it's not every day you get to have the Mason of the Year 2015 Colorado get on the podcast with me, so this is quite an honor.
Thank you. I assure you the honor is all mine. Yeah. Thank you. That was, they sprung that on me. That was a funny surprise. God bless them for doing that. Undeserved, but, you know, well taken.
Well, I think there's quite a few folks who probably think that you're mistaken about being deserved. You've done quite a bit for Freemasonry. For our folks who don't know you, you're a past master, I think, out at Norwood Lodge, number 111, is it?
Yes, that's correct. Yep, in Nuclear, Colorado.
Yeah, and Telluride Lodge, 56.
Yes, in Telluride, which is a fantastic location. Fantastic lodge.
And you're a secretary.
Yeah, that's my masochism creeping in there. I'm the secretary of research.
Yeah, you and me both.
It's a special kind of stupid to be secretary, doesn't it?
You know, it really does. Yeah.
But it is awesome. I love it. You know, I wish I had more time to devote to it, to be honest with you. I probably should have stepped aside, at least briefly, you know, considering all the other stuff I've got going on, but I'm loath to do it because I love Research Lodge of Colorado. It is it's a wonderful place to be, and I'm hoping in the future we can see great growth there. So I just want to be part of the team. You know, I don't know if you're like me, RJ, but when you step aside, sometimes you feel like you're just missing this great big chunk of irritation that you kind of need to get out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, maybe a little bit. Maybe a little bit. You know, for all of our listeners out there who don't know you, they might know the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine, but maybe they don't know Ben Williams. So aside from being the past master of a couple of lodges, secretary of the Lodge of Research, publisher, I would love for you to give us a little bit of insight to what got you into Freemasonry. How long ago did you join? You've got an accent. Where are you from? How'd you end up in Colorado? Let's hear it.
Wow. Okay. Well, the accent first is the easiest one to bring in. So, well, my mom was English. She is English. My father is American. So they split up when I was very young, and I grew up with my mom. I like to say that, you know, like the punks of the 1980s used to have tattooed on their forehead, I was made in England. but I'm actually an American citizen. I was an American citizen before I was English. I got my British nationality when I was seven. despite having lived there most of the time.
Wow.
As to the masonry thing, I mean, that is an interesting kind of story, and I'm going to borrow a quote from my friend Paul Harrison when I say, you know, I joined for entirely different reasons than the ones which made me stay, which I think is kind of interesting in and of itself. And I don't want to go into too much details here. It's going to sound a bit weird, and I don't mean to be cryptic. But to cut a long story short, I was actually in, you know, your old country on the West Coast petitioning political issues, which is an incredibly sort of wasteful way to not just make a career, but to dispose of democracy. But nonetheless, that's kind of how a lot of these ballot issues are positioned. Folks like me would stand outside of various, you know, shopping precincts, and we'd get paid per signature. And to cut a long story short, again, this is a great way to travel around. So I was traveling a bit then, and I was in Seattle, the Emerald City, and something strange happened to me. I was reading a tractate, which I picked up by accident, and it kind of found me, and I'd fallen down the rabbit hole unexpectedly. And of course, I never really even heard of Hermes Trismegistus, you know, or anything about the Hermetic tradition, so I brought no baggage with me, no preconceptions. And I will say that I'd always been a bit of a seeker, you know, in my youth. A wayward adolescence took me away from, I would say, the subtle and secret things and possessed me of my own kind of passions and led me down a dark space, which was necessary, nonetheless, I think, in a way. But it was interesting to have these things find me at this particular time. And in reading a short tractate on the definitions of Hermes Trismegistus to Asclepius, probably my favorite written material of all time, I had a kind of a life-changing event. And the end result of that life-changing event was basically Freemasonry, you know?
Wow.
I went in search of something where I thought the remnant lay. The Sufi have a saying when they talk about in search of the lost pearl. And I thought maybe, you know, Freemasonry was one such clan, if you will. And I believe that it is. But nonetheless, the reason I say it is, despite the desuetude, I would say, that the fraternity seems to be in, despite the written material from, you know, the 19th century and whatnot, and the other authors like, you know, Manly P. Hall, who, as much as I love him, probably doesn't well characterize the craft. I say because, well, on the one hand, there is a remnant. It's clearly in the ritual. It speaks of this awakening that exists in humanity as the ultimate destination, perhaps, of all people. Maybe that is the end of the Masonic journey. And then two, well, the brotherhood, you know. I've met some of the greatest people in this fraternity. And, you know, I don't know if your work says the same thing, but we say, you know, unites men that would otherwise remain at a perpetual distance.
Yep.
I certainly was blessed by that network.
Yeah, just fascinating. I think that you and I came into the fraternity likely for very similar reasons, going into some of the Hermetic traditions, the philosophies, on a search for, you know, I don't know, man, maybe something the profane world might call paranormal. And then through a further understanding of my own, you know, I subscribe to some wild stuff. But
I think they say, look at the world and tell me the pleasures of sanity, right? Look at the world and tell me the pleasures of normalcy. I mean, it's a lot larger than we realize, that's for sure.
I have to agree with you. What lodge did you first join? First thing, did you join in Colorado or California?
Yeah, no, I did. After this experience, I ended up basically quitting my petitioning job, and I got in the car, and I drove all the way from Seattle to Telluride without stopping. I thought to myself that Telluride would be just as good a place as any. Telluride was where I was before I went out west to sort of travel around. There would be as good a place as anywhere, this secret box canyon at the end of the road where the peaks mark the mansions of the moon, you know, in an east-west valley beset by rainbows, bejeweled by rainbows on a regular basis. Where better to sit and contemplate the lofty, subtle things? And I remember trying to give my shoes to the cathedral in Salt Lake City, but it was surrounded by construction at that time. This was, yeah, I think, 2003, maybe. So I ended up trying to give my shoes to some woman in a gas station as I was filling up my car, and she, of course, wouldn't take them. She probably thought, who is this strange young man trying to give me that dirty pair of shoes? It was a very important symbolic event to try to give up my shoes. And, you know, which is one of the reasons why the Book of Ruth, the teaching in the first degree, struck me so hard when I finally did petition the lodge. But I ended up joining in Norwood, Colorado. because I was living in Norwood at the time, and Norwood lodges in a place called Nucla, which is a very bizarre little town close to the Utah border, or close-ish, to a place called Paradox Valley. And it was incredibly active in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. There was a lot of uranium that was mined out of that area. In fact, unless I'm mistaken, one of the bombs dropped on Hiroshima or Nagasaki came directly out of that area, the uranium.
Yeah,
and anyway, with the decline of the uranium movement, they're basically defunctive. There were seven brethren back then who were amazing guys. None of them particularly esoteric, right? But all of them possessed with the proper approach to the degrees. I did it mouth to ear. You know, I didn't even know there was a single letter key until I was proficient on the third when they gave it to me with my Bible. Although, RJ, I got to tell you, I kind of suspected there was, because my coach, I love him. His name is Ben Sievers, and I'll never forget him. And this is why I'm such a traditionalist and believe that this method is important, because I'll never forget Ben Sievers. I used to drive down there to that broken-down lodge in Nucla, and I'd sit in that cold room with Ben for like an hour, and he would just go through it, you know, question after question. And anyway, I began to suspect there was a single letter key, because he would say to me, you know, rubbing his bald head, "Oh, Ben, I'm getting all bald up here, boy. I'm getting all bald up here." And he would go, "I'll be right back. I need prostate. I'll be right back." And he'd go to the bathroom, and then he'd come out and he'd have it down cold. So like, wait a minute. But anyway, it was, So Norwood 111 is always going to be, I got to tell you, my favorite lodge. And I'll never forget it. When I go through the memory work, that's where I am. Actually, yeah. I'm in Holly Ride a lot, too. That's what I see when I think about the preparation room and the stations in the lodge.
So you joined sometime mid-2000s then, huh?
Yeah, it was like, I think it was 2008, I'm going to say, is when I was raised.
Get out, me too.
Really?
Yeah.
That's great, Audrey, that's cool.
Yeah, that's pretty rad. I want to ask you a little bit about your works in Freemasonry, right? There's a lot of guys who are in the fraternity, they kind of find a niche, and they work at it, and sometimes they do some stuff, and it catches on with the lodge, and then they ask them to do stuff, and then the Grand Lodge catches on, and so on and so forth. And then there are other guys who do something, and nobody really cares, and they do it anyway, and it blows up, and it's great. You kind of have an in-between story, it seems like, the Rocky Mountain Mason, a lot of people think that's the state Grand Lodge magazine, but it isn't. I mean, it's an independent publication.
Yeah, no, it is. I guess I probably need to make that more clear. I didn't realize people thought that.
Well, it says it plainly on your website, but I get a lot of people who are like, "Oh, isn't that the Grand Lodge of Colorado magazine? Don't I have to be a Grand Lodge of Colorado Mason to get it?" No, just go to the website and subscribe.
Funny, it's the name, right? The Rocky Mountain Mason. Well, here's something funny, RJ. I mean, originally it was going to be called the Esoteric Mason. That was the original plan.
And Ben, I really want to hear this story. So let's start from the beginning. You started this thing. You were going to be, well, first, why'd you decide to do a magazine in the first place?
Well, I love writing, right? In my profession, I write all the time. I was a creative writer in college. I don't get to read fiction anymore because I'm reading The Law, which is don't do it. It steals your eyes from you and leaves you blind. But I had been working for magazines in Telluride. When I first got my job out there, I was sort of a ghost writer, so I just write for the different, you know, it's a tourist town, so they have very glossy publications to sell real estate and, you know, notify the tourists of where to eat and whatnot. So I kind of got involved in that business, and I got to see the side of production and publishing, not just, you know, ad sales and writing, but also the actual printing side. Now, there's something magical about printing. You know, this is why I produce a paper magazine. Everyone's like, "Why don't you go online?" Well, you know, we will and we can, but I like the paper, man. I hate to be wasteful, but I love it. And I don't know, I probably don't need to dwell on that point too much, but there's something magical in setting the press and seeing the machine work and manifesting this, turning a tree, you know, better as a tree probably, but turning a tree into something else, this transformation that occurs. Sounds a bit silly saying that, really. But I was working at a bank at the time. This was 2008, 2009. It might have been a bit later than that, maybe 2010. The credit crunch was in full swing because I ended up taking this crappy job at U.S. Bank in Norwood. And so I had time on my hands. And back then, you know, I'm not going to get into too much details about this, but Colorado was kind of an up-and-coming mover and shaker in, you know.
Yes, you were.
Yeah. And there were some really active brethren who were involved in pushing that forward. And I was privileged to be working in the background with some of those guys. So I put together this proposal to make a magazine, and I sent it to one such brother. And we had this plan, and we were going to get funded, and he was going to take it to, you know, variously important Masons in the Scottish Rite, and we were going to fund it through having, you know, a section for the Scottish Rite in the magazine. We were going to call it the Esoteric Mason. And without going into too much detail, something happened that ended up making that proposal kind of go elsewhere.
So let me cut in. I'm going to dig a little bit. on your website, right, so the story that we get from the website is the Esoteric Mason magazine was going to be this thing, and then somebody, like, steals it.
Yeah, I don't think they steal it. That's
right.
Probably not fair to say.
Yeah,
I would say it was appropriated. How about that? Oh, how
appropriate.
About this? Like any good idea, perhaps, if this is a good idea, but like any good idea, often two people have it at the same time. And I was...
Marconi, Edison, Tesla. Next.
Tesla, always.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And even Graham Bell on the telephone and whatnot. So, yeah, inventions kind of manifest, right? So this idea was obviously, let's just say, I hate to personify masonry, but why not? Masonry in Colorado was kind of bringing forth this idea for a means of connecting people and reestablishing a network of shared ideology, philosophy, a forum for discovery. And I think, unbeknownst to me at the time, the brother I was working with and for whom I put together this proposal, who was far more connected with the movers and shakers who could make it happen than I was at the time, he was concurrently working with another friend of his who also had the idea. Now, I don't know if he was before me or after me or if we inspired each other or what happened, but I sent... I'll just tell you. So I put together... this one brother asked me to put together a mock, basically, in InDesign. So I put together this mock in InDesign, and it was just, you know, placeholder text. It was squares and rectangles. And I put it together and said, ad goes here, ad goes there, front page, boom. And I sent it to him. And then I didn't hear back from him for like months. And then, you know, another friend of mine came out with another magazine, you basically using that layout as a template. I was crushed, actually. I felt very betrayed. But at the same time, you know, what was I going to do about it? It was bigger than me, right? I couldn't do it alone. I didn't have any money back then because I was working at a bank, and bankers don't make any money at all, believe it or not.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know what? I'll just help these guys with their magazine. And so I did. I pushed it, and I got them subscribers, and I was, you know, I was a good worker bee for these guys because I believed in the cause. At the end of the day, things kind of changed, and certain things were revealed to be not as they were meant to be. And, you know, I like to say this, if the end justifies the means, then that means the end. So that's kind of what happened. And there was a lot of colorful characters involved, and, you know, things kind of, I don't want to say stuff that will identify anybody in particular.
Yeah, no, I totally understand. We are a tight-knit community of Freemasons, and anybody who has done really anything in this fraternity that's any kind of noteworthy, we kind of all know each other, and we all know the rumors about each other and everything. So yeah, I get it. It's not a big deal. But then it leads out to, what, like 2013, March, your first issue of the Rocky Mountain Mason.
Yes, Andre, I think you got a better understanding of the timeline than me.
I read your website, Ben.
Well, maybe I should have it open. No, absolutely, you're correct. So I moved to Denver, and actually just before I moved to Denver, I had got this job writing patents. You know, I used to do the Telluride newsletter, and I did it for the trestle board. I did it on an old Xerox machine that I bought for 25 cents from the library when I was working at the time, and I ended up printing the trestle board on legal paper on this old, out-of-date copy machine that could never be repaired if it broke, which is why they got rid of it and why they gave it to me, and I basically gave them 25 cents consideration, and I had to load it into somebody's pickup truck to get it to my house in Norwood. Came straight from the Wilkinson Public Library. Anyway, to cut a long story short, one of the brothers of Telluride Lodge was a patent attorney from Montrose, Colorado. He'd come there from Arkansas, from Little Rock. And he'd set up shop in Montrose for some unknown reason. But nonetheless, he ended up hiring me to ghostwrite patents for him. So it was fantastic. It really was. You know, my income increased dramatically. I wasn't making tons of money by any means. But suddenly I had more money than, you know, 29 grand a year at U.S. Bank does not really cover the bills. You know, I was lucky I had some savings that I frittered away to stop the foreclosure of my house during that time. But then, you know, I was making better money than that all of a sudden, and I really only worked maybe 3 days a week. You know, he paid me $500 per patent I wrote, and these were not sophisticated patents, right? So this is not weeks of writing. This is simple consumer products that were fairly easy to churn out. So I could write a couple a week, you know, and that was enough for me then. So I thought, I can afford to print this magazine. You know, I can make this magazine. And sure enough, I did. I totally self-funded it. I found a printer. Actually, my girlfriend at the time found a printer, which I'm never going to reveal because they're amazing. And they gave me probably the best short-run printing deal that I've ever been able to find. That does not mean it's cheap. It's still absurdly expensive to print a glossy magazine and mail it.
It is.
But, you know, I was able to do it. So I thought I'd give it a try. And knock on wood, it's been, gosh, coming up on, you know, 8 years.
I got to say, it's one of the only magazines out there that, you know, at one point there was, it was Rocky Mountain Mason Magazine, there's Fraternal Review, there was Living Stones, and also the Working Tools magazines. And all four of those were really article-driven magazines that you couldn't wait to get because then you could read in-print articles about, you know, historical and esoteric concepts that weren't tied to, say, some Grand Lodge agenda or some Grand Lodge library or what have you. You know, the one exception being, I guess, the Southern California Lodge of Research's magazine, Fraternal Review. They're not super, like, tied to Grand Lodge. They still produce a theme article-driven magazine that's not like, oh, and by the way, check out the charity we did this week.
Yeah, I think they're from the Research Lodge. Of
they are,
it's
yeah.
Amazing. It's a great magazine. It really is.
I love it. You know, 10 issues a year, 17 pages an issue, and it's great. But the only other contender, you know, is an independent magazine. You're the only independent, really, Masonic magazine out there with phenomenal content. It's a huge magazine, number one. If for anybody listening, pages and pages and pages of content, and it's not like, I mean, you have like a couple ads in the magazine, but they're generally great ads for things that we would want anyway, because it's fraternal.
Yeah, we don't fund it with advertising.
Yeah. I mean, and the price point is, I got to ask you on the price point. I said I would ask $33. I mean... I said I would ask. I mean, is it symbolic or is it just the price point?
No, it's totally symbolic. You know, Ajay, between you and me and, you know, the fence post, as they say, it turns out $33 is probably not a good price point to run a magazine by. But, you know, it's totally symbolic for sure.
For the content that you get, I tell everybody that I don't know how Ben does it for $33 because...
I lose my shirt on it.
Yeah, well, the pages are not super thin. It's not newsprint. It's a glossy magazine. And
that's 70-pound paper. Yeah, all the way through. Yeah, all the way through. No, it's a quality, you know, and it's not computer, right? This is a letterpress. It's the real deal. That's why you get those beautiful serifs on the fonts. And, I mean, like I said, I love that the printer has done me a great turn on it. But I will say this, Ajay, if I may, it is finally breaking even, which is fantastic, you know. And when I do make a profit, I usually give it to my team. I am so lucky to have the team that I've got because, you know, when this thing first started, it was me doing everything. I was doing layout, editing. I wrote most of the articles. In fact, if there's not a byline on the article, I probably wrote the damn thing. And I did that for a good few years. Patrick joined me in Volume 2, which is fantastic. Patrick has been a great contributor to the magazine.
Yes.
And now I know he's been a guest on this show. Patrick, if you're listening, I love you, man. Thank you for everything you've been doing. I mean, you've taken this magazine to another level. And
holy cow. Hold on, Ben.
Yeah.
I just realized. I've had you on the program, had Patrick on twice, and I interviewed Pablo Columban when he was the worshipful at Denver for a series.
That.
I've had everybody involved in Rocky Mountain Mason on this show.
Except for our ad sales guys.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll get them on.
They sell ads, by the way. But, yeah, no, Pablo is who I wanted to get to next. I mean, Pablo's layout is just friggin' beautiful. And when I, you know, you can see the difference. You know, yeah, this is a shameless self-publicity here, but if you don't already own the first years or the first 2 years of magazines, go online to the website and look at them. And look at, just look at the layout. You don't even have to read the stuff. And then look at today's and look at the difference. And that's the difference between, you know, me, who has a very rudimentary control and command of InDesign, versus Pablo, who is just brilliant. I love Pablo. He's just a fantastic guy, number one. He's incredibly likable. He's got great charisma. You know, he I don't know what he does, man. He goes out there and he, like, hunts things with his bare hands. He's kind of frightening. meanwhile, he's a city slicker. He lives in downtown Denver. Anyway, you spoke to him. He's like, yeah, so we're very blessed.
Yeah, we did. With Pablo, I had an episode. It was 10 questions with 10 worshipful masters. So I randomly shot out, you know, some requests. I said, hey, if you're interested in being on a podcast and you're worshipful this year, send me a message and we'll set something up. So I interviewed just 10 rando worshipfuls from all over the United States. And Pablo was one of the guys who was recommended. And he sent me an email, said, yeah, let's do it. And I didn't know. And it turns out that my best buddy, Scott, he was a member at Denver. He's still a member of Denver Lodge. And he's like, oh, I know Pablo. And I was like, what? Small world, right? So these guys are all fantastic. Patrick, I've had on twice. The first time we talked about some of his writings and the poetry. I think it was Greenleaf.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know he's doing some amazing research on.
Yeah.
And also H.P. Bromwell. In fact, you know, shameless plug here, Patrick is going to be producing a book on Lawrence Greenleaf very soon. And, you know, keep your eye out for it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we talked at length about this and about Bromwell and also some of his interest on medieval grimoires just a few weeks ago.
Cool. I haven't had a chance to listen to it yet, RJ. I hate to say that. I will, I promise.
You got to check it out. It's amazing. Really great stuff. So you've been producing this magazine since 2013 now, so 7 years, almost 8 years now in the making. And then coronavirus hits just, you know, a month or two ago, and here you are, and apparently you're not busy enough being all the things that you are. You're twiddling your thumbs, and you say, I'm going to start a podcast.
Yeah, that's basically what happened. So, we were locked down, and it wasn't that I didn't have work to do. I didn't have new work coming in. I had a whole backlog to get through, and I was like, yeah, I'll get to that later on. And I was just sort of fooling around. And I recorded it through the first one. I just read the speech that I gave once into my Mac and just thought I'd see how it went, you know. And I hate to say this, RJ, it was so much fun. I really enjoyed it. I mean, maybe I just like the sound of my own voice. I don't know what it is, but I really enjoy doing it. So I was like, you know what, screw it, I'm going to do another one. And, you know, I've just been reading old articles that I wrote, you know, so I don't have to infringe copyright or worry anybody about stuff. So I don't need permission. I got plenty of them. In the 2 weeks that I first started, I recorded enough episodes to get all the way through June.
Oh, yeah. And what's great is that you're doing these weekly. If you guys don't know, if you go to Rocky Mountain Mason Magazine, right on the front page, it's right on the right side under the magazine. You can see it says listen to our podcast. And if you click on that link, Ben's got, one, two, three, four, seven episodes up already.
Yeah, one came out today. It's May 20th when we're recording this. So, yeah, one just came out this morning.
Yeah, the awe-inspiring chess-playing robot of brother Wolfgang von Kempelen.
Which is a great story. It really is a great story. And a hats off to Tom Standage, who now works for The Economist magazine, by the way.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, he wrote a book called, I forget what it's called. It's like The Turk. It's something similar title to that, but it's all about Kempelen's, yeah, it's a great book. Strongly recommend it. But no, that's a fun story. I hope, if you haven't listened to it, RJ, please do.
Yeah, it just came out today. It's on my, you're already, like, I subscribed to your podcast. I think, so I listen to, people always go, oh man, as a podcaster, how many podcasts do you listen to? And, none. And they're like, what? Yeah, I don't listen to any podcasts. Well, how do you know? And I was like, okay. So, I listen to infrequently and not all the time, but I'll catch up when I have time. I listen religiously. I used to listen to Juan Sepulveda's Winding Stairs because his production value is just, it's so stupid awesome. He made me want to be better as a podcaster. So I listen to Juan to get really inspired about stuff. And then, of course, we do Masonic Roundtable, right? But I don't I don't listen to it because, you know, I do the show, this show, and then the only other, like, now I have two other podcasts that I listen to, and one is Black Vault Radio with John Greenwald, because I love Freedom of Information Act and UFOs and stuff. But
that's cool.
Then the other one now is Rocky Mountain Mason. So, yeah, you're in my feed also. And
I love it. Thank you, sir.
I used to just crank through podcasts on my 48-minute, you know, commute to work there and back. I know 48 minutes sounds like a lot, but live in D.C. or L.A., it's worse. Trust me. So, yeah, I listened to your show and a couple other just rando podcasts, but I don't know. Do you find that you listen to a lot of podcasts out there, or was this just something like, oh, I think I'll podcast?
Well, yeah, it was like, oh, I think I'll podcast. You know, I started listening to podcasts in doing it, right? Just to sort of, I knew that they were out there. It was just something I was completely unfamiliar with. You know, it was never really on my radar. And then just in doing it, I started listening to it. I've listened to yours. I've listened to, I'm not going to remember the names of these. There's some, it's like, I've been listening to sort of a cult podcast.
Right? Oh, yeah.
You know, which I probably shouldn't say, because I don't know, sometimes the occult has attracts interesting characters.
Well, we have a lot of characters in terms of the occult, and you know, the audience of this show primarily knows that you know, I'm a member of other organizations.
Mm-hmm. Like what?
Well, I mean, you know, like there are some things I'm a member of that I don't talk about, but I mean, like, I'm a member of BODA, which is Builders of the Adytum.
Yeah, Paul Foster Case, love you, Rick.
Yeah. So, like, I study that stuff, you know, fairly every day, right? I do some reading on that. But I would say that most of our listeners kind of understand that. And we actually, for a time, had something that was like, you know, the esoteric minute. And I would have a couple guys come on and talk. Or we have these really super esoteric talks with one of my old writing partners who just went by Frotter O because he didn't, you know, his business, where he works in security. And so he works in security stuff, so he can't really be outed for a lot of the stuff that he's into. But so we talk a lot about that, and there's sensitivities about it. But for the most part, as you say, a cult does have somewhat of a sometimes people just think it means it's scary or it's, you know, devil-y or whatever the case is. But you know, just hidden stuff, interesting philosophical gnosis things. I don't really, the thing that comes to mind right off the top is one of the best podcasts out there that one of my best friends and brothers, right, is Greg Kavitsky of the Occult of Personality podcast.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's exactly the name that I thought that was eluding me. That's it.
What's your goal with the podcast? Where do you want to go? Do you think you're going to continue doing the podcast through the pandemic? What can we expect? I mean, it's such a good publication, and it seems like you've got a rhythm down.
I'm going to try to keep it going, Ajay, to be honest. If I can, you know, I'm going to try to keep it going. I think weekly is not too bad. You know, if it's half an hour to an hour, I'm going to mix it up with interviews. So my plan originally was to do one interview a month, and that would be like an hour long. And I've got a couple of those that are coming to air. Next one is with Right Worshipful Brother Kevin Townley.
Oh, nice.
On my show. If you have an RJ, you should definitely have Kevin Townley on your show. He's an amazing guy.
Oh, yeah.
He was one of the original founders of the American chapter of the Philosophers of Nature. So he's very well acquainted with Paul Foster Case. He's an old BODA guy. In fact,
he is.
So you know him, right? Exactly. Yeah. The other one I'm excited about is with my friend Mark Savish from the Institute for Hermetic Studies. That one's going to be coming out towards the end of June. And then I had another one scheduled, but the guy who agreed to do it has been very busy and just kind of dropped off the face of the earth. So I'm not going to chase him up, you know. Maybe I can reciprocate, Ajay. Maybe I could interview you.
Hey, anytime you want to talk about weird stuff.
You got it.
I'm your Huckleberry. I'll be your Huckleberry for sure.
Excellent. Well, can I ask you a question, actually? Said about like UFOs and stuff. Have you been watching the whole Skinwalker Ranch thing on History Channel?
Yeah, so I knew about Skinwalker Ranch years ago, and then all of a sudden I hadn't heard much about it, and then John Greenwald on his Black Vault podcast had a dude come on who used to work there, and I started listening to it and what he was talking about, and I was like, oh, man, I need to get back in it. And then all of a sudden, what? Now there's a whole show. My wife and I started watching it, and, you know, there's this whole crew of kind of like New Agey, UFO, let's talk real science, but be open to the different possibilities. I don't think now, I don't think there's been a time in history where people have been more serious and open to the idea of religion and philosophy blending with science than right now. And I think what we're seeing is like a lot of the supernatural stuff and the things that people are interested in. I mean, Curse of Oak Island, Ancient Aliens, and Skinwalker Ranch are like the three number one rated shows.
Wow. Yeah, I'm not surprised, actually. That's great to know, but interesting, yeah.
But yeah, I definitely follow the Skinwalker Ranch stuff. I had a joke post I put out on Winding Stairs Freemasonry Group that said, who wants to do the third degree at Skinwalker Ranch?
I saw that, man. I think I said I'm in.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, you know what I did, man? I was trying to interview somebody right from there. And I actually wrote to the real estate magnate who bought the place. He didn't respond, of course. I'm looking. Maybe I shouldn't say this, but I got onto the county, you know, maps around there, and I got the property records, and I contacted owners of parcels around Skinwalker Ranch, and it turns out that's like one parcel that's owned by this. I think there's like four guys, and they got some weird name. It's like, I forget what it is, Electric Wolf Research or something like that.
Oh, weird.
And you know, I think they probably partake of you know, curious substances, but nonetheless, they're right there. And they're sort of like overlooking the ranch itself. They're on the other side of the road, but they can see the actual escarpment or whatever it is where all the stuff happens. So if you want to go out there, maybe we could talk to them. I think it'd be a bit weird going out there, to be honest. Like you got to be careful with some of that stuff. But you know, it's not too far away from where I am.
Yeah, I think, like I said, you don't know till you push, right? So here's what's up. I've got some trips that are kind of, you know, on the rocks until after this virus. But after this virus, I think we just need to make that happen. We'll just drive out there.
Let's do it.
Yeah,
I tell you what, I know where it is. I know exactly where it is. So go out to the Juanita Basin, and I know a bunch of the Utah brothers who I don't know if they want to come along or not. They certainly would be hospitable. I don't know if they live in that area. They're more Salt Lake City guys, but still, nonetheless. Actually, Masonry's pretty small in Utah,
which is odd considering. Well, I don't want to talk. I'm not going to say that there's connections because maybe there are, maybe there aren't. But it seems like a contingent of folks who maybe live there think that it's not.
Well, I think most Mormons would agree that Joseph Smith borrowed heavily from the degrees. I think most of them would. They would disagree about some of the other stuff, probably.
Yeah.
I think it gets heated because some folks like to say that they stole it or counterfeited it, which is probably not a fair characterization.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. As we kind of get back to the topic of Freemasonry a little bit, I need to ask you about your outlook on Freemasonry. You came in around the same time I did. I didn't know that. And when I came in, I was like, oh, this is really great. Not what I expected, but this is great. And then I had to find my way in Freemasonry, find what I wanted to look for and do what I wanted to do to get what I needed out of the fraternity, right? This is kind of where I got my idea of when people said, you get out of it what you put into it. And I read a lot and I got out a lot. We've seen this change in education. You referenced Colorado having emerged, you know, the butterfly from the cocoon, and it fought its way out. You know, if a butterfly can't escape the cocoon himself, right, he'll never fly because he's got to work the wings. And you did that. And Colorado did that. And the wings blossomed and it flew. And some wild things happened in Colorado administratively. You got TO lodges that just blew up and people love. And then things kind of settled down. And now Freemasonry, it seems like across the United States, is starting to value and get a little bit more serious. And now COVID comes along and education just rams it right down administration's throat with presentations every single night, you know, on Zoom and Skype and non-tiled places. And all the educators are carrying the craft now, right now. But in the future, what do you think the future is for Freemasonry, Ben?
Wow. So a big question there, RJ. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, Masonry is such a varied path. There's as many lodges there's as many cultures as there are lodges, and there is as many sort of Masonic philosophies as there are brethren, right? So the way that I see Masonry is likely going to differ from how, you know, it is a unique view, and I think everybody has a unique view. I would say, though, that there's kind of two ways to look at this issue. One, what would I like to see Freemasonry become, or how would I like to see it apply in my own life and my own sphere? And then two, what is it that Freemasonry is? Because Freemasonry allows a multitude of opinions, a multitude of faiths, a multitude of approaches for the exploration of the will of the majority, right? It is, in a sense, an exercise in self-governance and self-improvement. And, you know, I'm going to go out on a limb a bit here and say one of the vital important parts of Masonry is kind of the administration side. And I realize that's boring. But I've always said, if your minutes are boring, it's because your lodge isn't doing anything, right? The minutes should be interesting. You shouldn't just defray the minutes because they're dull, right? If your lodge isn't giving you education, come to lodge with something to say, right? No one learns more than he who teaches. So if you want education and no one's doing it, become the change. And I think that's the important thing. So when I speak about what I'd like to see Masonry become, I'm really talking about what I would like to become in Masonry, right? And in that respect, I would like to have and already enjoy a network of well-informed brethren with whom I can discuss the subtle ideas in an atmosphere of tolerance. What I would love to see happen more from my experience with, you know, the Rocky Mountain Mason Facebook group and various other sort of, you know, social media influences, is this ability for the minority opinion to be properly heard and entertained without it getting so vitriolic. And I don't see that in lodge, but I do see that online among brothers. So it seems to me that we are perhaps lacking a kind of understanding of the I don't want to sound cheesy here, but the working tools themselves, right, to maintain an open mind, to entertain ideas. You're never going to learn something if you always take the classes that you want, right? If I was able to choose my own curriculum in school, I would only reinforce that which I already know. And I see that happening everywhere in the echo chamber of the social media bubble. But in my own experience, I found the most surprising, edifying understandings precisely where I least expected to look for them. You know, I mentioned Hermes Trismegistus before. When Mercury jumped in my lap, so to speak, if I had any preconceptions, my images would have prevented the emptiness which that virtue came to fill. Similarly, you know, in the most boring social science of all time, economics, I found great discoveries in the likes of Adam Smith, who I completely misunderstood and mischaracterized until I read him, you know. So I think this sort of dialogue is incredibly important. Okay, now that that's out of the way, I think Masonry needs to reclaim its influence. We are a serious force for social change, because when I change my own mind, I change my world. When the lodge acts the way that it's supposed to act, it embodies a type of virtue, and I use the term virtue in the way that Cornelius Agrippa would use it in his three books, right? I don't mean it as a kind of high emotional or moral state of being. I mean the virtues that crystallize from heaven, the rays, if you will. So the lodge, when it functions properly, exemplifies a type of virtue that I believe affects the entire community surrounding it. Not just in the charitable undertakings the brethren pursue, right? Not just in the building and the example of well-dressed men, you know, being connected and working in the community, but just by its presence alone and by the working of the gentle craft, like a tuning fork, right? We're playing a major triad on the piano of our community, and all the tuning forks will start to resonate in tune. And if we do that properly, I think we can bring about the type of world, and this sounds incredibly idealistic, I realize that, but we can help bring about the kind of world that desperately needs us. And I think COVID-19 is revealing that we need a social change, not just the fraternity, humanity. We need a new way of operating that doesn't consume the planet, right? If everybody consumed at our level, four Earths would be required to sustain the global economy. We have such discrepancies in wealth and production precisely because we cannot sustain the consumption that we are fortunate to enjoy. Now, of course, I want to maintain this level of comfort and richness, and everybody deserves access to it. But we need an economy, I believe, that works on a decentralized platform enabling creation, right? Entrepreneurialism. Should Masonry therefore become exemplary in leadership in this capacity? You know, lodges are behind. We don't have Wi-Fi, a lot of them, although, of course, a lot of us do now, but a lot of rural lodges don't. A lot of them are holding the line. You know, should we be moving towards decentralized energy production? Are there other things we can do to exemplify a philosophical shift in consciousness that may usher in a more sustainable and equitable future? I don't know.
Right.
High polluting moralizing there, but
no, you know, here's what's up, Ben, is for a long time, when you ask people, you know, what's Freemasonry all about? And you find that Freemasonry really tends to be about the things that are needed most to find its mission in the current state of things. And when we look at some of the most recent events when Freemasonry really had an impact, you can look at things like, I don't know, colonial America, the founding of America, the great experiment that really drives home this idea of civic engagement, of standing up. And you know, we talk a lot about justice, and contextual justice is bringing something up to your level. This is almost political welfare talk. And this is a problem that I see as you were talking there. People listening might go, wow, Ben and RJ are starting to sound a little bit political, and I don't know how I feel about that. And the thing is that I wrote a paper about politics and religion being banned in Lodge, and I said, I think it's kind of stupid, because I necessarily think that Freemasonry has essentially neutered itself by not being able to talk about things and how to help the society, because political agencies tend to take on those risks. And so the only way we can really implement a global shift in consciousness to better the human condition is to dive in philosophically and allegorically, really contemplate the symbols and the lessons of the degrees. And then you enact those changes and hopefully cause, you change the way, as you said, you change the way you think, you change your reality. And then when more people start thinking about being responsible in these ways, energy and economy and all of these things, we start to see changes in the way the world works. Now, do I think it's ever going to go Star Trek and there is no money except, you know, the Ferengi and Latinum? I don't know. But it's not, I don't think it's silly to think about that stuff. I think that's real. If there's anything that's real, you know, that's some real talk. It's not just asking about the weather and, you know, when somebody walks in the lodge and says, hey, better to be seen than viewed, or, you know, whatever. Like, that's the small talk. You know, people say when you got nothing to talk about, you talk about the weather. And when we talk about real issues, that's when I think people start paying attention. And they pay attention and they either do one of two things. They get involved or they get scared.
Right. Roger, I think you and I are of the same mind, buddy. I mean, we can't deny that Masonry is about transformation. It is about transformation. It's about personal transformation, right? If I apply the degrees correctly, I should be changed. I should be changed from when I knocked on the door of the lodge to when I was raised by this, you know, on the 5 points. I was going to say something I shouldn't say. So if I'm changed by it and I work on myself sufficiently and become that which I wish to see or that Masonry best represents, one by one, Masonry does change the world, one world at a time. And of course, I think we have this in our degrees. You mentioned the early experiments of the United States. I'm currently working on a paper about the founding of Freemasonry in Colorado, which was then, of course, Kansas Territory, known as Pike's Peak Country, named after Zebulon Pike, by the way, not Albert Pike, although they were distant cousins. And Freemasonry is here at the very start. There is no doubt that Freemasonry provided the forum for practiced self-governance, the context for relief, mutual assistance, charity, a network, and a common purpose. There is no doubt that Freemasons were at the fore on the frontier of arranging the social constructions necessary to administer a society. No doubt. So Masonry is concerned with these things. Absolutely. I wanted to say this too, if I may. You know, you mentioned that people talk about the weather if they've got nothing to say. This is why we got to stop the minutes being about the weather, right? The weather being the bills. So we don't want to get rid of minutes. We don't want to put the minutes on the door. We don't want to get rid of business. It's very important, I believe, for the Masonic institution to be able to conduct business in the forum that the assembly, the self-governing assembly allows, with the proper rules of order and etiquette. So the minutes need to be about, you know, what are we doing? What's happening? Not just charity and stuff too. Can I say this as well? I always thought that the enjoinment against discussing politics and religion is against proselytizing. If I came to Lodge and I wanted to give a talk on the Holy Saints John, am I not talking about religion?
Yeah, you are, but it's a Masonic context. And people tend to do this thing where they just automatically go, oh, you can't talk about, I mean, you couldn't say you wanted to raise X amount of dollars for Planned Parenthood in a lodge, could you?
I don't know. I mean, it depends. It depends on the motivation. Like,
yeah, well, in my area, they'd bring you up on charges.
It's a political position they think you're taking.
Exactly. A political position backed by a religious ideology. So there are these lines in the sand that people draw, and when they're too connected, as they are in far either way direction politics, it essentially destroys the ability to talk about a lot of these things.
Which is a true shame, really, right? I mean, I think if I was saying, hey, we should all go vote for, you know, the Republican candidate in the county commissioner's election, I think that would be problematic, right? Although, yeah. You know, I would like to say that not every jurisdiction is like this. So, for example, in France, the largest jurisdiction in France is not recognized by ULI, but it's nonetheless the biggest jurisdiction in France, and it has the most influence in France. They talk about politics all the damn time.
Yeah,
and it's
that's
probably
their goal.
Too political, right? I mean, Sarkozy got in trouble for laundering money. Well, one of the lodges, actually, that was the Grand Lodge de National de France. That was the ULI lodge. Got in trouble for laundering money for the Sarkozy campaign. Maybe I shouldn't bring that up. But it is crazy to think that the ideas of self-governance that we enjoy in the United States and that run this country are not of concern to Masons, because in a very real sense, although we didn't originate them, we certainly facilitated them. I honestly believe, without a shadow of a doubt, and maybe I'm a romantic, that the United States is a Masonic country. I really do. I think the Constitution is a Masonic document, and I can trace the lineage, and others have, and, you know, Chris Hodapp has done some great work on this, going back to, you know, the Union of the Carolinas by Daniel Cox, right, and the Albany Plan of Union by Benjamin Franklin, the first book that he published for the national distribution then among the 13 colonies, being Anderson's Constitutions. He published it, I think it was 1734, right, when he became Grand Master of Pennsylvania, into the Articles of Confederation and into the Constitution. When I look at the founding of Denver, we see the Auraria Town Corporation set up by Freemasons. We see a quorum of the board being Freemasons. I mean, to deny the social mechanics that really allow democracy to prosper are not of interest to Masons is to say no Mason should read Thomas Paine. You know, it's absurd. It drives me crazy. And I don't think you should stand up there in lodge and try to, you know, get people, beat your political drum. It's not about grandstanding, as I'm probably doing right now, for which I apologize. But I think discussing political theory in lodge should be encouraged, if it's in the right format. You know, I shouldn't just stand up and bring up politics on the side. You know, worshipful master, I'd just like to say that I really like the Democratic candidate this year. That would be probably unacceptable. But if I was to give a presentation on the different types of tyranny, right, what is wrong with that, right? What is the
nothing.
Authoritarianism, the challenges?
Nothing is wrong with that.
Right?
I would love nothing more if I went to a lodge meeting. You know, my lodge meetings are typically at Space Nova. We had to create a lodge to do the educational content that we wanted and assigned readings, all these kind of things. But I could imagine at a more normie lodge, somebody can stand up and say, hey, today we're going to read an essay that's in, you know, the Rights of Man. And that should be okay.
Should totally be okay. I've got a great example for you. I was in Telluride Lodge, and I was senior warden, and my buddy Chris Pike, no relation to Albert Pike or Zebulon Pike, as it happens. Unfortunately, he's deceased now, good old Chris. He died young, mysteriously died of a heart attack in his house in Ouray. But anyway, I'll miss him. Chris is not all there. Right, Chris was kind of he's a great guy. I love him, and always will. I love his memory. But, you know, he was kind of just not all there. And so we were trying to get the education going in Telluride, and I'll never forget this. As the master of the lodge, he brought a map with him. He had all these materials, and he began the education portion of the meeting. And it was all on, you're going to love this, RJ, it was all on the hollow earth, right? The earth is hollow, man, okay? So, I mean, Chris was from California originally. He was obviously, you know, raised in sort of curious circumstances, and he was a bit weird. He lived alone. And anyway, he's going on about Admiral Byrd and the hole that is invincible from the South Pole. He's maybe 5 minutes in to this long presentation for which he's got all these wonderful accoutrements. Whereupon John Davis, now also deceased, stands up and says, "Virtual Master, I make a motion that we dispense with the education portion of this meeting immediately." Second, from the sidelines. You should have seen Chris's face. Like, I mean, he's crestfallen, right? So I'm thinking to myself, number one, yeah. I don't really want to hear this presentation either, but the mark of an educated mind is the ability to entertain an idea without accepting it, right? And two, this is clearly good for Chris. This is good for him to get his conspiracy theories out, because they're going to fester like mushrooms and fungus if they don't get some air and sunlight on them. And two, he's talking in front of people. This is good for him. So I spoke, and I thought eloquently, I will say, on the issue that we should listen to the presentation irrespective of what it is. Unanimous vote to end the meeting. So I was crushed, but that was, you know.
We got to have, so you're the second interview coming up. So this Sunday I've got an interview out, and then you're the next one that comes out. So not this upcoming week, but the following. And people listening are like, what's he talking about? But in the previous episode to this one, I have on Lou Elias, the first worshipful master of the first regular women's lodge in America.
Oh, wow.
And we started talking about some of these concepts, and you said something that she said.
Wow.
You said you're putting an emphasis on the idea of self-governance, and I do that also. And I have a slew of people who do, but she makes mention of this idea of Freemasonry as an initiatic society that frees the person and turns them into a free builder, then into a builder of themselves to improve their self-governance, and then advances the human condition. So it's really funny that back-to-back guests, people who don't know each other, relating to these concepts.
Each other, by the way, but that's okay.
it's really interesting just to note that the concepts that you guys are, I don't know, maybe we're just all birds of a feather, and I'm just geeking out on that.
No, Audrey, I think it's in our degrees. I think if you pay enough attention, it's in the beautiful eloquence that we say, you know, every time we meet Masons. It really is, if you pay attention. And I got to say, you know, the Lady Masons, the Dwarf Humane, they are far more esoteric than we, to a member, you know, maybe successful, and they're more interested.
AHAF is women only, and they are exactly what you describe. They are very esoteric. They write papers in between degrees. They expound on the meaning of the symbols and stuff. That's what they do. But they also fire on the other cylinders of Freemasonry, being, you know, civics and charity and fellowship.
So, which is the material results of the former. Yeah, I remember I saw a newsletter, and this was by the Dwarf Humane, so they're co-ed, but it was shown to me by a brother here. Really, he was like the first law firm in Denver, his family. He's been here forever. And he showed me this, because he wanted to write for the Rocky Mountain Mason, and anyway, he showed me this newsletter from the Grand Lodge, which is down in Larkspur. And wow, it was all about the Shem HaMeferesh and, you know, Kabbalah, but not at an introductory level. You know, it wasn't super advanced either, but it was a far cry from the stuff you see, you know, our members entertain. Yeah, I was impressed significantly. They're all theosophists as well, that group. So
yeah, Ledrette Humane is heavily influenced by theosophy, which take it or leave it. I mean, there's like three main branches, I guess. The Adyar, right? That's a big one. So the Adyar is in India, but they have a satellite, basically a campus with bookstore, Quest bookstore and everything. Oh, I don't know, 40 minutes from my house. I want to ask you, throughout our conversation, you have talked and you've mentioned a few books and authors and philosophers. And as somebody who is esoteric-minded, who puts together a magazine and reads a lot, and I want to ask, because I think it will give some people some really good foundations if they're interested, if you could recommend three books, Masonic or otherwise, that you feel are invaluable to understanding, let's just say, whatever philosophy you feel is at the core of Freemasonry. Could you give three examples of books you feel would be good to start with?
Yeah, sure, I can. And I'm going to go, you know, obviously there's many different ways to approach that question, and there's many, many answers. I think it's important to understand the Renaissance mindset when considering the subtle philosophies that inform Masonry. Masonry is a curious tension between, and you mentioned this union between science and, you know, for want of a better word, magic or whatnot. But in the Renaissance, those two things were one and the same. So Masonry emerges in the speculative, era, in the Enlightenment, in this curious move away from the older philosophies, which still adorn the lodge and still are behind the letters, and represent the emergence of science. We see this in the second degree lectures about the machinery and nature. They use the term, machine, and the simile of machinery as a directed hand of God. So here we've got this opposing sort of tension. So I would strongly recommend a review of that. There's a very short book. It's called The Renaissance World Picture by Edmund Tilliard, and it essentially presents, for want of a better word, the worldview that informed the Renaissance mind. And it's a very different way of seeing reality. It's a very, it's kind of Shakespearean in a sense. I would also commend to students of the craft Gershom Scholem's work, and I would probably begin with The Origins of the Kabbalah. It's not an easy read because it's a very academic presentation on the history of this rabbinical thought that we term Kabbalah. And that is, I think, definitely worthwhile. And I would love to throw out a whole bunch of other books like the Bahia, and of course the Zohar, which is insane. It's insane to recommend that because it's so big. There's millions of others. But one I think is important for the Western mystery tradition, having digested Edmund Tilliard's book, then having gone The Origins of Kabbalah, and maybe delve into Agrippa's seminal text. And I know this is like the cornerstone of the Western mystery tradition, to quote Donald Tyson, who edited the current volume, but is Cornelius Heinrich Agrippa's Three Books of Occult Philosophy. Because this 26-year-old or 24-year-old, however old he was when he wrote it, did an amazing, amazing job in collating and synopsizing a very large body of spiritual sympathies, so to speak. And actually, as a monk, he was a monk. So the book is kind of, it looks scary. The word occult is in there, which of course is occultation, meaning that it's hidden or overlooked or unseen. And they make it black with fancy weird white letters on, which they probably shouldn't do, to sort of sensationalize the material. But, he was a monk, and he wrote the book to Trithemius, who was a very important thinker as well, and a very quiet guy in the background. His work is also earnestly commended to the students' attention should somebody want to delve that far. I would love to give you a whole bunch more books, Ajay, but I probably should stop because I would go on forever.
What was the first?
It's called The Renaissance World Picture by Edmund Tilliard. It's a very thin book. The purpose of that book is to try to recondition a way of seeing. One of the things we are brought up in, the world does change with how you look at it, right? As Obi-Wan Kenobi says, a great many things depend on perspective. So we're brought up in a very reductionist, empirical worldview. And you really get a sense of how lost we are from the way that it was when you consider the works of Shakespeare, for example. When you consider, it's hard to really understand the concept of astrology from a modern perspective. And in fact, all of, in my opinion, New Age astrology has emerged in a way to try to fit the modern worldview into these older precepts, which don't obey the laws that we can empiricize, if that makes sense.
So the
world picture is very, it basically tries to present that idea. Actually, I've got a podcast coming out kind of on this topic. I chose a time period, an event. The discovery of the longitude is one such moment in human society which represents perhaps more than any other. And remember, this took a guy's entire lifetime. It took about 60 years or so. But it represents this point in time where we can see man take his perceptions from the above and the behind, if you will, the invisible, and moves into the world of his own contraption, into his own contrivance. We move from the time of the stars and the lunar, solar, local moon, lunar solar phenomenon into the regular repeating increments of a man-made system. And it's both good and bad, but it's a very interesting departure. And what is so fascinating about that story, of course, is that John Harrison wasn't awarded the Longitude Prize, despite having, for all intents and purposes, met the requirements twice with his marine chronometer, simply because the Board of Longitude, which comprised a lot of Royal Society men, men with our worldview, I would probably be a Lunarian, you know, in that day and age, simply because they were fascinated with the stars, with the trestle board of the heavens. I think they would find the science of horology not necessarily repugnant, but certainly too anthropomorphic or anthroposed, if I can coin that term, you know, man impositioning himself. How dare you, John Harrison, you arrogant fool, you know? Anyway, I should get off my soapbox. I apologize, but that's why that book is important.
Wonderful. What was the first occult book that you read that you can remember that left an impression on your mind?
Sure, man, I can totally remember. Because, as I said, having been a... So my mom is something of a, I don't know, a practitioner. She speaks to animals and she can make plants grow and all that kind of stuff. So I kind of grew up in it with an idea of a mysticism.
My mom's kind of a new ager, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
So I wasn't really into the occult at all, you know, because of, I think, the scariness of it all and everything else. But I was actually, I hate to say this, when I was a kid, I memorized the New Testament. I was actually quite Christian, which is a good thing. I still am a Christian. But I mean, I was more kind of Christian. My perception of Christianity would fit more with the prevailing view of what Christianity perhaps is. I don't know. But the book that I read that changed everything for me was The Picatrix, the Gayat Afakim.
And how old were you when you read that?
I was, let's see, at about 2 days, just before, when I was, the definitions of Hermes Trismegistus to Asclepius that I mentioned before, I was reading The Picatrix at the same time. So it was in Seattle where I got The Picatrix. It was the very first translation, English translation, ever printed.
And what made you pick that up?
Well, I fell down the rabbit hole. It's kind of an odd situation. I don't know. Like I said, okay. I happened to be there, and I found out about it by accident online. I fell down this rabbit hole with a man I respect enormously, a guy called Christopher Warnock, who has done perhaps more than any other. Well, actually, that's not true. There's a lot of the guys from Project Hindsight, but Chris is always going to be near and dear to my heart. Chris was a student of Robert Zoller and the Project Hindsight guys, which include Rob Hand, Robert Zoller, and they were basically reawakening medieval astrology through translating old Arabic books and Latin texts that had never been translated to English before, except in, you know, pieces like Bernati's pieces of certain source material had been translated into English, but not the whole stuff. And so they were resurrecting these old techniques, and they were trying to restore, as we are maybe trying to do the Masonry, this New Age movement to these sort of thousand-year roots. They got thousands of years of techniques that have been ended obsolete. And I don't know if I stumbled across Chris's stuff before The Picatrix or afterwards, but somehow I happened to be at the very place that The Picatrix was being printed for the first time. And I thought, well, I'll just go in and grab it because I'm right here. Why not?
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. And like I say, it found me, right? And the same with the Hermes Trismegistus, this is a wonderful little book. It's in English, and it's very short. It's in a tradition book. It's the new translations of the Corpus Hermeticum and the definitions of Hermes Trismegistus to Asclepius. And I was buying books inspired in the Portland Library. It might have been the University Library. And that's where I got my copy of my three books of occult philosophy, same time and place, was in that library. And the last book I picked up was that thin little book with Thoth on the front, or Tote, you know, Jehuti.
Jehuti.
Yes. And, those are my first foray into that material. Although, you know, I had seen the three books before, of course. I had a weird friend of mine in college who gave it to me and asked me to interpret a part of it, because I've always been into this kind of stuff without meaning to be. And he was a really interesting guy. I realize now he was a wizard. He was a wizard, and he was a student, but he was a wizard. Okay, can I tell you the story, Roger? This is going to sound a bit strange, but I walked into his house, and this guy used to, you know, off the record, he used to kind of, you know, grow certain plants.
Yeah.
He would,
well, those plants are recreational and pretty much legal everywhere now, Ben, so.
Well, this is true, but at the time it was not. So he would grow them, and when I walked in, he would keep this very quiet, and I was introduced to this guy by another friend of mine, you know, was kind of an intercessor. I wasn't there to buy stuff or anything, but, you know, they were friends, and he kept his friends very, very close to the chest, so to speak. And so I walked into this house, and I told him that I felt kind of uncomfortable. There was some sort of weird energy in the house, and he goes, well, you're not a thief, are you, Ben? And I'm like, no, I'm not a thief. You know, I don't steal anything. I'm honest to a fault. And so we started talking about mercury. And, you know, he was really into this stuff when he was in his 20s, long before I was. And so he gave me that book then to read this part about the virtues. And he had made some sort of, I don't know, some sort of spell, right? Some sort of mercurial working to prevent thieves from entering his house, is, I guess, what had happened. But, you know, whether or not it was efficacious, I don't know. But I will say I felt really weird walking in there, and I brought it up. And that's what started the conversation. But the first book I read was the Picatrix.
Well, Ben, one of the things that I wanted to ask a little bit about before we wrap for the episode, we talked in the beginning of the show about the Esoteric Mason and how it transformed into the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. And just a few weeks ago, you're a real jerk because you put out this teaser that the Esoteric Mason is coming back. And then I go to your website and I see June 2020. Is this still going to happen? Is this real?
It is real. June 21st, it's coming out. Hopefully we'll be on time. It's always difficult to know with production issues and case law, you know, and my job and everything else.
I get it.
Yes. I'm super psyched. And RJ, if you ever want to contribute anything, by all means, please. This is a slightly different audience than the Rocky Mountain Mason, I'm hoping, but I believe there is a demand for it. And in fact, I know there is, because the number of sign-ups, you know, pre-sign-ups has been telling.
Yeah, I shared it everywhere, and I know guys were sharing it all over the place. I think it's going to be a wonderful new outlet to be able to dive into the deeper side of things a little bit, perhaps into some of the concepts, you know, expounded upon in some of the books that we talked about here, you know, tonight. So aside from that, we're going to make sure we have in the show notes, we're going to put up some of these books that Ben talked about. We're going to have links back to Rocky Mountain Mason magazine. Ben, I want to thank you also because we had a number of guys who have come forward and said, you know, we were unsure. We wanted to come to MasonicCon Chicago, and we were just going to buy a ticket. And then when we saw the executive pass came with a subscription to Rocky Mountain Mason magazine, it put it over the top, and we went for that executive ticket. So I just want to thank you for your support for MasonicCon Chicago. You know, even if we go digital pivot, you know, if we have to do that, I don't think it's going to go that way. But if we do, you know, everybody still gets their subscription. I just want to thank you for working with us to make that happen for all of our ticket holders also.
Well, Javi, thank you, buddy. Thank you for the opportunity. Glad to help. Glad to be part of the team. And appreciate the publicity, too, really.
You know, this is Freemasonry is a passion. And I think you and I share that passion in terms of transforming human condition and consciousness, and while building toward that, coming out with relevant and fun and interactive media that assists people on their own journeys, you know, looking at different perspectives, pulling the red thread on different things. And I just got to thank you for all the stuff that you've been doing, especially since the publication of the magazine, and that you never gave up. It's so important to me when I hear the stories of fellows like yourself who you meet some headwinds, but then you just break on through and you keep on going. And, you know, we find this newfound respect for, you know, everybody in the community who's putting out all this great content. So thank you.
No, thank you, Roger. It's nice for the recognition. I appreciate it, buddy.
Yeah,
hey, every adversity is an opportunity for change, right?
This is true. This is true. So everybody, just want to thank my guest one more time. Brother Ben, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Hey, thank you, RJ. It was a real pleasure.
Absolutely. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that super cool interview with Brother Ben Williams of the Rocky Mountain Mason magazine and Laughing Lion Publishers. Brother Ben has given us quite a few cool books to check out. So actually, if you're interested in any of those books, in the show notes, you'll see a link back to the bookstore. So on the bookstore, you'll see a section at the top that's books by those who've been on the show. And if you scroll down a little bit more, you see RJ's personal recommended reading. And just under that, recommended by our guests. This is where you're going to find the three books of occult philosophy. I've got two versions there. One has the commentary by Donald Tyson, which is a little bit more expensive, over $100. Then there's a lesser version, which still has the text there, which I think is 15. Also, Ben had alluded to in the interview one of the books he called Renaissance World Picture. It was just interesting. I couldn't find the book, and then I discovered that perhaps Ben misspoke there. And so I contacted him, and he said, nope, sorry about that. It's called The Elizabethan World Picture. There is a link back to that book as well. And in addition, we've got The Origins of Kabbalah, The Lesser Key of Solomon, all these great books, The Way of Hermes, The Picatrix, all these great books that have been mentioned by some of the more esoteric-minded gents who have been on the program, all available right there. You just head on over to the bookstore and scroll down and click on the links. They'll take you back. And if you shop through here, we get a little bit of a kickback, pennies on the dollar, but every little bit helps. So not an ad or anything, just that's how you can help us out. Now, next week on the program, we're going to have Brother Gerald Fortune, who will be on, and he's got an amazing story to tell from where he came from, his views on Masonry, and it's going to be a little bit more of an esoteric episode. We're going to talk about lots of cool stuff, and I think you all will thoroughly enjoy it. Then after Brother Gerald Fortune, we'll have on most worshipful brother, illustrious brother, Akram Elias, past Grand Master of Washington, D.C., of course, we had his wife on, Worshipful Master of America 57, in the last episode, 446. But I'm having Akram Elias on to talk more about the project that he and I and a few other brothers you may know of have been working on, the Masonic Legacy Society. If you want to know more about Masonic Legacy Society, head on over to MasonicLegacySociety.com and check out all the information available to you. To get that guide and document, you got to have a little skin in the game. So you'll need to put out your name, phone number, any of the information that goes in there. It just comes to me, so you don't have to worry about me selling your info or anything. It's just to me, Brother Robert Johnson, the guy who brings you a weekly podcast for the last 10 years. You can trust me, not selling you out, but go there, check that out. And again, that document is available for the Masons or anybody interested in practice of becoming a free person, a free builder, a builder of the human condition, and that includes the profane. So keep that in mind. If you have not joined yet, this is not strictly for Freemasons. It's for anybody interested, although Freemasons will find a great more value in what it has to offer. That said, that's all for this week. I want to thank you all once more for joining me on this amazing journey. If you'd like to help out this show, become a contributor, a fellow, or a producer, head on over to WCYpodcast.com, click on Support the Show, and see how you can help. If you'd like to write me, my email is WCYpodcast@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Facebook or wherever else. I'm pretty much everywhere. And we'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.